started at an old mission that housed the casket of the Spanish explorer who had said the first mass at the site of what was to become the city. And he was very silent as a priest guided him through the buildings until, coming to the coffin, he saw the dates of the explorer's birth and death, 1519 and 1574, and then the only words he spoke were a number, 55. He was going to be 55 on his next birthday. He seemed unable to escape reminders that time was running out on him. But when he was met at the gates to the Stratus plant, there was a black man on the welcoming committee, which sat behind him on the platform as he spoke. Sitting in the audience, Reedy heard people saying that, as he was to report to Johnson, this was probably the first time in the history of the county that a Negro had appeared on the same platform with a white speaker. At his next speech, at the dedication ceremonies for a memorial to St. Augustine, there was also a black face on the platform, and at the banquet there were two Negro tables, and they were, Reedy says, good tables, close to the speaker's platform. Reedy and Peake were sitting at these tables when Peake suddenly got word that Johnson wasn't coming down from his suite until it was time for his speech. He understood that Johnson was nervous. He didn't want to have anything that was a situation, but he went upstairs to Johnson's suite to protest, telling him that not showing up for dinner would give the appearance that he was boycotting the blacks. "I'm eating with them," Peake said. "At least you can come." Johnson came downstairs with a grim expression on his face that Reedy knew all too well. But as the vice president looked out over the hall, he seemed to relax, and his speech went well. While members of the audience were coming up to his table to shake his hand afterwards, he caught Reedy's eye, with a look that Reedy understood. He and Peake brought the little group of African Americans up to the dais, and Johnson was, Peake says, very cordial with them, very cordial. They had a good time talking to him. As he turned away after a while, one said, "Don't forget us, Mr. Vice President." His flight back to Washington that night was in the small Matt's Jetstar he detested. But flying back with him, Peake, who during his 11 years as Smathers's assistant had spent enough time with Johnson to know his moods, saw that he was very happy. Happier than he had been for months, Reedy says. In a memo summarizing the St. Augustine trip, Reedy wrote that a major breakthrough on the color line was achieved because, in allowing the events to be integrated and in agreeing to negotiate about segregation in the city in general, local people had made concessions which, in light of the history of St. Augustine, are startling. This evaluation was to prove over-optimistic. When the next day at 9:30 a.m. a 9-member NAACP delegation went to City Hall for the promised meeting, there to greet them in the commission chamber were no commissioners but only a tape recorder sitting on a bare table. A city functionary told them they could record their complaints on that. The commissioners had been unable to attend, he said. Leaning forward one by one to talk into the recorder, the black men and women asked for the removal of colored-only signs, at least in city-owned facilities, for the inclusion of at least one black person among poll watchers at elections, and for the end of various other humiliations routinely inflicted upon black residents of the city. One of the nine, a carpenter, said that when his sister had died recently and he and his family had gone to City Hall to obtain a death certificate, we had to stand on the outside to give the information they wanted. It was cold and raining. No response would ever be vouchsafed to the delegation's requests, no attempt by the commissioners to live up to their promise to Reedy. With Johnson gone, the leader of the delegation came to realize he had lost any leverage with the commission. A report later sent to Washington concluded that St. Augustine officials regretted the extent to which they had cooperated with Johnson. They feel that they went even further than they should have gone to accommodate the vice president when he was here. Yet despite this denouement, and despite the fact that he had no power to do anything to change the situation, Lyndon Johnson had not accomplished nothing, in George Reedy's opinion. The mere fact that blacks had been in the banquet hall had not been meaningless, he said. One of the Negroes said that never before in the history of the hotel had a Negro eaten in it except in the kitchen. The whites have had the experience of sitting down in the city's finest banquet hall with Negroes to eat a meal. The roof did not fall in and the walls did not collapse. Furthermore, they have had the example of one of the highest officials of the United States insisting upon equality. And the incident in St. Augustine had an effect also on that official. Fighting on a civil rights issue, taking a step, however small, against racial injustice, trying to do something for people of color, had always roused something in Lyndon Johnson. That had happened again from the moment he insisted that the hall in St. Augustine not be segregated. After his return to Washington, his staff saw he was revved up as he hadn't been since the start of his vice presidency. His depression was gone. After months of refusing to give interviews, now when Reedy left him a note saying that Jack Bell of the Associated Press wanted one, back came a note saying set up a date. He even agreed to do one on television, his first since the earliest days of his vice presidency. LBJ last night broke his self-imposed silence to deny allegations that his post of vice president is a comedown, Evans and Novak reported on March 28th. Facing three reporters from ABC, he seemed calm, poised, and content as he said, "I am very happy. I have everything a man could want. I have a lovely family. I enjoy my work. I've never felt that the vice presidency was a comedown from anything except the presidency." The only tense moment came when a questioner noted that Johnson had once reached for the presidency himself. "I don't consider that I ever reached for the presidency," he said. "My friends put me in the race. I didn't feel I was a candidate. I didn't go into any of the primaries." Now that he was involved in civil rights again, the uncertainty was gone. He understood the importance of gestures, gestures that indicated respect, to people starved for respect. And he knew just what gestures to make. The great African-American singer Marian Anderson was giving a concert in Austin. The city's university-centered liberal community welcomed the news, but there was a studied disdain from its conservative establishment. Johnson invited her to visit and stay the weekend at his ranch. He knew just what words to use. Every year, the press club for African-American journalists in Washington tried to get a high-level speaker from the federal government, sending invitations first to the president, then to the vice president, and so on down the cabinet, as a club officer put it. None had ever been accepted, but in 1963 the club was able to stop with the vice president. The other speaker was a southern governor, Terry Sanford of North Carolina, who called for moderacy and restraint on the civil rights issue, sounding, in the opinion of the Washington Afro-American, like the siren call of the last 100 years, like the last grunt of the chorus of the Volga boatmen. And then the vice president spoke. "The sands of time are running out," Lyndon Johnson said. "The hours are short, and we have no moral justification in asking for an extension." 6 years earlier, he recalled, when the first civil rights law had been passed, he had said that half a loaf was better than none. Now, he said, "It seems to me that we are well past the stage where half a loaf will do." He understood, the Afro-American said, the reasons that drive colored men and women to fight for their rights these days. Before he spoke, a young black woman, shortly to graduate from a Washington high school, had been called to the stage and awarded a scholarship to enable her to go to college. At the end of his speech, Johnson turned to her and said she would probably need more financial aid than the scholarship would provide. She should come to his office, he said, and he would see she got it. While he was shaking hands after the speech, an African-American woman came back to her table holding one hand in the air. "I shall never wash this glove," she said. He decided to accept an invitation to deliver the Memorial Day speech at the Gettysburg Battlefield in Pennsylvania, where, 100 years before, Abraham Lincoln had given a speech. He had received the invitation months before, but had told his assistant Juanita Roberts, the former WAC colonel, to decline. Among other reasons, he was afraid his speech would be compared to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. But Horace Busby had begged Colonel Roberts not to send the letter, and she, aware of how often Johnson changed his mind, and hoping he would change it this time, simply filed the invitation away. Now, after his success in St. Augustine, he asked her if she had replied to the invitation. When she said she hadn't, he told her to accept. A few days before the Memorial Day weekend, he had Busby come out to the Elms, and they sat by the swimming pool and talked, with Johnson doing most of the talking, about what should be in the speech. He expected Busby to follow their usual practice and turn his rough views into a polished speech, but this time the speechwriter didn't think much polishing was required. "I knew what I had heard," he says. He had been writing speeches for Lyndon Johnson for 15 years, and he felt that this time Johnson had said exactly what he wanted to say. In Busby's car was a large, clumsy recording device, and, he recalls, as he was driving away from the Elms, "I stopped the car a half a block away and recorded what we'd been saying," pretty much as he remembered it, "and the next morning took the recording to his office and had his secretary transcribe it. And when I saw the transcription, I got very, uh-huh." He added 2 introductory paragraphs and 1 at the end, and took back to Johnson essentially what Johnson had said to him by the pool. It was a very short speech, much shorter than the usual Johnson speech, and he had expected Johnson to discuss it with him, to change and edit it, and to tell him to add to it, and he had expected Johnson to tell him to clear it with the Kennedys. But, he was to recall, "I didn't hear any more from him." The next thing Busby saw or heard about the speech was when he read it, in the Washington Post, as the lead story in the Washington Post. So short was the speech, barely 2 typed pages, that it had taken Johnson only 8 minutes to read it. But Lincoln's speech had been short, too, and the Post said in an editorial this one, too, had eloquence, political courage, vision. 100 years ago, the slave was freed, Lyndon Johnson had said. 100 years later, the Negro remains in bondage to the color of his skin. The Negro today asks justice. We do not answer him. We do not answer those who lie beneath this soil when we reply to the Negro by asking patience. To ask for patience from the Negro is to ask him to give more of what he has already given enough. The Negro says now. Others say never. The voice of responsible Americans, the voices of those who died here and the great man who spoke here, their voices say, together, there is no other way. And for a while, it seemed that the speech would be just the start. His longtime Texas allies had phrases to describe how Lyndon Johnson threw himself into a cause, even if it was sometimes a cause in which he had not previously believed, even if it was, in fact, a cause he had previously opposed, phrases to describe the revving up, the working up, when he made himself believe in the cause absolutely, with total conviction, when, as Egg Clark puts it, he could convince himself something was right and get all worked up and emotional, and work all day and all night and sacrifice and say, "Follow me for the cause. Let's do this because it's right." And, Clark says, Johnson would believe it was right, no matter what he had believed before, so that, as Reedy says, he acted out of pure motives regardless of their origins. And in the case of helping people of color, there had always been something very pure about Lyndon Johnson's motives. Definitive though his 20-year record of voting against and carrying out Southern strategy against every civil rights bill might seem, it was not in fact the whole story. Even during the early years of his life, the story had had a very different side. At the age of 20, he had been a teacher in the Mexican school in the desolate South Texas town of Catulla. No teacher had ever really cared if the Mexican children learned or not, until Lyndon Johnson came along. And it was not only the children whom Lyndon Johnson taught, so that the school's janitor, Thomas Coronado, could learn English. He bought him a textbook, and before and after classes each day sat tutoring him on the school steps. The anger, sometimes just about to tears, of which aides spoke was something they saw often when Lyndon Johnson was talking about the indignities that his black household staff had to suffer in their daily lives, whether it was because he had had to do nigger work as a youth, picking cotton, chopping cedar in the hill country, or because as a Johnson he had felt the sting of unjust discrimination, there had always been within Lyndon Johnson genuine empathy and compassion for Americans of color. It had been kept hidden for years, 20 and more, because during those years compassion conflicted with the ambition that was the force that drove Johnson more than any other. But when in 1957 compassion had for the first time coincided with ambition, the compassion had been unleashed. And it was unleashed now. May of 1963 had been the month of Birmingham, of Martin Luther King's desperate decision to throw his last resource, children, into the fight to desegregate that tough southern city. The month of the fire hoses. "They've turned the fire hoses on a little black girl. They're rolling that little girl right down the middle of the street." And of the dogs, the big German shepherds that Bull Connor's police kept on leashes, but not tightly. And all that month, the president and the attorney general and their aides were discussing what to do in Birmingham, and whether or not to propose new civil rights legislation, and what that legislation should be. But they hadn't been discussing it with him. On Sunday, May 12th, after bombs had exploded in front of the home of King's brother, and at the motel where King himself was supposed to be staying, Kennedy headed back from Camp David for a long day of crisis meetings with his aides and cabinet members, who arrived at the White House in a procession of limousines. The 2nd Infantry Division and the 82nd Airborne were put on alert, and the paperwork was drawn up to federalize the Alabama National Guard at a moment's notice. None of the limousines contained the vice president. That afternoon he was at a garden party at the home of Congressman Hale Boggs, where the gathering buzzed with rumors of what was happening at the White House. So all the guests were aware that whatever was happening, the vice president was most definitely not a part of it. The administration was drawing up civil rights legislation, but he was not part of that either. For the past 2.5 years, Johnson's response to such exclusion had been to retreat into silence and sulking, but he didn't retreat now. He asked to meet with the president, and when he was put off, he kept repeating the request, finally on Saturday, June 1st, telling O'Donnell, this is what Lyndon Johnson had been reduced to, that in the words of one administration official, he thought he should have 15 minutes alone with the president. At 10 a.m. on Monday, June 3rd, Johnson was allowed into the Oval Office, with Robert Kennedy and O'Donnell and Sorensen already there, discussing the civil rights bill. But in the course of a very brief meeting, the president asked him if he had anything to add. And he told the president what he thought should be done about the legislation. And after listening to him, Kennedy asked him to repeat his thoughts in detail to Ted Sorensen, and said Sorensen would be calling him, which Sorensen did that afternoon. And since at last the president had asked Lyndon Johnson for advice about civil rights, he gave some. It was advice on 2 levels. One, the lower level, was about tactics, and it was advice from a master of tactics, from the most effective Senate leader in history. A leader who had, in fact, done what the president was saying he wanted to do now, pass a civil rights bill. He didn't know exactly what was in the Kennedy civil rights bill, he told Sorensen. I've never seen it. I got it from the New York Times. I haven't sat in on any of the conferences they've had up there with the senators. I think it would have been good if I had. But sending any civil rights bill to Congress at the present moment was a tactical error, he said. It wasn't that he didn't want a bill, Lyndon Johnson said, but other major legislation that Kennedy needed hadn't yet been passed. Sending up a civil rights bill before all other major legislation was disposed of was a very bad idea. A traditional Southern tactic, one that had been perfected by Richard Russell in a score of civil rights fights, was to delay consideration of other major bills in the Senate while waiting to take up civil rights. If the other major bills had been disposed of by the time a civil rights bill arrived on the Senate floor and precipitated a filibuster, it would be the only major piece of unfinished Senate business. But if other major bills remained to be disposed of at the time a filibuster brought Senate activity to a halt, other senators would be faced with an unpleasant reality. There were only 2 ways to end a filibuster, by a cloture vote or by abandoning the bill that was being filibustered, withdrawing it from the floor. Since, as the 1960 cloture vote had demonstrated yet again, winning such a vote was highly unlikely, senators would realize that if the civil rights bill was not withdrawn, if the Southerners were not allowed to win, if instead the Senate decided to fight it out on the filibuster front as long as it took and not move on to other business, the other necessary legislation might not be taken up. Those other bills would therefore become hostages to civil rights. Hostages held in Southern hands. They couldn't be released until the filibuster was ended, and the Southerners wouldn't allow the filibuster to be ended until the Civil Rights Bill was abandoned. Eventually, the pressure to pass those bills would become so great that civil rights would be abandoned. So, Lyndon Johnson said, I'd move my children, the other bills, on through the line and get them down in the storm cellar and get it locked and key, and then, and only then, when the other bills were safely passed, I'd make my attack. But Kennedy wasn't doing that. A number of necessary bills, most notably his proposal for a tax reduction that would give a boost to a stalled economy, were still in the legislative process, still before committees in either the House or Senate that hadn't yet released them to the floor so that they could be debated and voted on. By sending up a bill at the present moment without getting the other important bills out of the way, Kennedy would simply be playing into the Southerners' hands. The year was half over. We've got 6 months, we haven't passed anything, Johnson told Sorensen. I think he ought to make them pass some of this stuff before he throws this thing out, introduces the Civil Rights Bill. The Southerners and the Republicans were just laughing at them for introducing it now, Johnson said. They're sitting back giggling. If I were Kennedy, I'd pass my program before proposing a Civil Rights Bill. He's got plenty of time to propose. You ain't even going to get started discussing it until September anyway. You got to pass your tax bill. You got to pass some of your other bills. September is just about the time. He tried to warn Sorensen, tried really to warn the president through Sorensen, since the president wouldn't give him the time to explain it to him directly, about other traps ahead and how to avoid them. He tried to explain to Sorensen how the Senate works. That when the time came for the vote on cloture, you weren't going to have some of the votes you had been promised, because senators who wanted civil rights also wanted, needed, had to have, dams, contracts, public works projects for their states, and those projects required authorization by the different Senate committees involved. And 9 of the 16 committees, and almost all of the important ones, were chaired by Southerners, or by allies they could count on. And then, should the authorizations be passed, the projects would require appropriations, the approval of the actual funding for them, and the Appropriations Committee was stacked deep with Southerners and their allies, who took their orders from Richard Russell. Or senators needed to have other non-public works legislation vital to their states, and such legislation often faced other but also Southern-controlled congressional barriers. Senators weren't going to be told that a project they desperately needed depended on their voting against cloture. No direct quid pro quo was going to be mentioned. The Southerners weren't that crude. And crudeness wasn't necessary. After a senator's pet project simply didn't move forward week after week, month after month in the appropriations process, and week after week, month after month, he couldn't seem to get an answer as to why, he would eventually figure out the answer for himself. And the same was true, if to a somewhat lesser extent, in the House. When he, Kennedy, sends this civil rights message, Howard Smith, chairman of the House Rules Committee, is going to be in the lead in one place and Dick Russell in the other place. And they're going to sit quietly in these appropriation committees, and they're going to cut his outfit, his sexual apparatus, off and put it in their pocket and never mention civil rights. So before the message was sent to the Hill, Kennedy should make sure he had the committee chairman behind him. He ought to get his own team in line about chairman of committees. The administration seemed to think it meant something that Hubert Humphrey, the assistant leader, was for the bill. What power did Humphrey have? What the hell is Humphrey? We've got to get some other folks to get that cloture. That meant sitting down with the chairman, discussing the proposed legislation with them, hearing their views and their objections, incorporating them in the legislation, getting their support in advance before the bill was introduced. Waiting until a controversial bill was introduced to do that was to help doom the bill before it ever arrived. The other level on which Lyndon Johnson talked to Ted Sorensen was a very different level, a level on which Johnson seldom talked, for he despised politicians who talked about principled things, and it was principles, a moral commitment that he was talking about now. I think that I know one thing, he said, that the Negroes are tired of this patient stuff and tired of this piecemeal stuff. And what they want more than anything else is not an executive order or legislation. They want a moral commitment that he's behind them. Kennedy hadn't given them that commitment, he said. Legislation, no matter how well written it was only part of the answer to the civil rights problem, he said. The Negroes feel, and they're suspicious, that we're just doing what we got to do to keep their vote. Until that's laid to rest, I don't think you're going to have much of a solution. I don't think the Negroes' goals are going to be achieved through legislation. What Negroes are really seeking is moral force and to be sure that we're on their side. And until they receive that assurance, unless it's stated dramatically and convincingly, they're not going to pay much attention to executive orders and legislation recommendations. They're going to approach them with skepticism. And only the president himself can give them that assurance, Johnson said. What they want to know is the president's own heart is really on their side. If he said so, I believe they'd believe us. But he has to say so, himself. No legislation, no spokesman will do it. We got a little popgun, and I want to pull out the cannon, Johnson said. The president is the cannon. This aura, this thing, this halo around the president, everybody wants to believe in the president and the commander-in-chief, Johnson said. That was the weapon that could beat the South on Capitol Hill, Johnson said. As it is now, he said, without such a commitment, the president's message doesn't get over. The telephone call was almost over. The president asked me this morning, do you have any suggestions, Lyndon Johnson said. Yes, he had, he said. I've had some experiences. Whenever he wants them, I'm available. Well, I'll pass all this on to him, you can be sure, Ted Sorensen said. Throughout the conversation, Sorensen had been carefully noncommittal, but he apparently passed enough on to the president so that the next morning Johnson met with Kennedy again. And that afternoon was the first of a series of meetings that had been scheduled with leaders of various groups. This one was with 100 executives of America's largest retail chains to mobilize opinion behind the civil rights effort. Kennedy had invited him at the last minute, and when he spoke, some members of the Kennedy administration who had never seen Lyndon Johnson revved up saw it now. Sitting in the rear row of straight-backed gilt chairs in the East Room behind the executives, Arthur Schlesinger felt almost as if he was watching a Southern preacher. Kennedy was wholly reasonable, appealing to the intellect. Johnson was evangelical. He was eloquent, all out emotionally. Whatever doubts Schlesinger had entertained about his sincerity on the issue evaporated that afternoon. He realized now, he was to say, that Johnson was a true believer. 6 more of these meetings would be held during the next month, and Johnson would be at all of them. And anyone who observed the courtesy with which the president treated him at these meetings might have imagined for a moment that Lyndon Johnson was being given, at last, a significant role in the administration. Sometimes the president referred to him almost as if he was a partner. This is a very serious fight, he said at one meeting of leaders of civil rights organizations. The vice president and I know what it will mean if we fail. He began to invoke him as an authority. When at another meeting, labor union heads asked that a fair employment practices law be included in the civil rights package, Kennedy said it had been decided not to do so because there was not the slightest chance of its passage. He and the vice president had discussed this with congressional leaders, he said, and they were both certain of that. Sometimes, during this period, Johnson's demeanor seemed to be changing back to what it had once been. For a couple of weeks there, he started to look almost like the old Lyndon, George Reedy says. His monologues were starting to be punctuated with dramatic gestures again. Once in the Taj Mahal, while he was explaining to his own aides what points the president should make in a speech on civil rights, he said that Kennedy should make the point that while he could order Negroes into a foxhole in a foreign country to fight for the American flag, he couldn't get them into Southern restaurants while they were on their way to join their units to go to the war. They couldn't get a cup of coffee while they were on the way to die for the flag, he said, and with his huge hand he grabbed the flagpole of the American flag that stood beside his desk and shook it in his rage at the injustice. But only for a couple of weeks, thanks to Robert Kennedy. At a meeting on June 22nd in a crowded cabinet room with 29 civil rights leaders, The president had to leave early for a trip to West Germany, and he asked Johnson to preside in his place. As Johnson was speaking, Bobby, sitting on the opposite side of the long table, beckoned to one of the men standing against the wall, the black newspaper publisher Lewis Martin, deputy chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And when Martin bent over him, he whispered, "I've got a date and I've got to get on this boat in a few minutes. Can you tell the vice president to cut it short?" Having worked with both men, and being therefore more than a little afraid of both, Martin was, he says, absolutely thunderstruck by this assignment. Trying to dodge it, he went back to his position against the wall and did nothing. But Bobby motioned him over again. "Didn't I tell you to tell the vice president to shut up?" he said, with the glare that Martin had learned to fear. "I can't explain and describe adequately how he could talk to you," he says. "But anyway, I was in such a dilemma I had to do something. The vice president was going full steam." Edging his way around the table and coming up behind him, Martin bent over and whispered, "Bobby has got to go and he wants to close it up." This time the glare was from piercing dark eyes instead of pale blue, and he didn't stop for a moment. He just kept going. I didn't really know what to do. I knew the vice president, once he was aroused, was a pretty tough gentleman. I was really sick. Luckily, after 10 or 15 more minutes, the meeting came to what seemed to be a natural end. During the same period, the Kennedy administration, casting about for areas in which it could quickly demonstrate its concern for civil rights, was eyeing the CEEO, enlarging the committee's powers, or to be more precise, giving it some in fact instead of theory, would have enlarged Johnson's, so that wasn't in the cards. What it was decided to enlarge instead was its jurisdiction. An executive order was drafted giving it authority not only over the federal government's own construction projects, but over all construction projects, state, local, and private, that were financed even in part by federal funds. The executive order would thus allow the committee to identify more instances of discrimination, while leaving unchanged its inability to act effectively against them. Essentially meaningless though the order was, it would nonetheless be a fundamental change in the committee's mandate, and it was discussed during several weeks of meetings in the White House, with Robert Kennedy a central figure. Not only was the committee's chairman not included in the discussions, he was not told about them. Lee White, who was coordinating them, was to explain that he simply forgot. "I checked with every damned guy in government, I think, except Johnson. There was nothing deliberate about it. There's no goddamned rational explanation for it, except that in my mind he wasn't part of the machinery." He wasn't even told about the executive order on the day, June 22nd, it was issued. "I've never seen a more surprised, disappointed, and annoyed guy than Lyndon Johnson when the President of the United States issued the executive order changing the jurisdiction of his committee," White says. He accepted the slight with as much dignity, about as good as a guy can get when he gets a mackerel in the face, as possible. And then there were two meetings of the committee itself. With the Battle of Birmingham still raging and civil rights on everyone's tongue, Conference Room B at the State Department was filled for both meetings, with Johnson and Hobart Taylor, his young black supporter from Detroit, whom he had made the CEEO's executive director, sitting at the head of the long conference table. Around it, high-ranking officials, cabinet members, agency heads, liberal luminaries like UAW President Reuther and Dean Francis B. Sayre of the Washington National Cathedral, and sitting against the wall, a full complement of their staffers. And, unfortunately for Johnson, also present at the first of the meetings was Anthony Taylor, whom he had invited so that Lady Bird's brother could get a view of him in action. When Johnson called this meeting to order, the Attorney General's chair was vacant, but he came in a few minutes later, Burke Marshall behind him, and, recalls Reuther's assistant Jack Conway, within a matter of 3 or 4 minutes the vice president found himself on the defensive because Bobby just tore in, demanding precise statistics on Negro employment in federal agencies in Birmingham from Hobart Taylor. When Taylor tried to explain that the statistics were not yet available because a new form that would show them had just been developed, Kennedy demanded, "Well, where is the form?" Taylor said it was in the final stages of preparation by the Budget Bureau and that he expected it to be ready shortly and to have the statistics by the next meeting. Kennedy was not satisfied. "Where in the Budget Bureau is it?" he demanded. He wanted to know where it was right then because he would expedite its completion, Judge Lawson says. The young man sitting beside Johnson, the man he had brought in to run the committee, was now getting quite upset. When an embarrassed Johnson tried to intervene, on his face a dark flush and his voice almost inaudible, Kennedy snapped a few more questions, not at his aide, but at him. At this point, Bob turned to someone and wanted to know about the Negro apprenticeship program. But while the official he addressed was still talking, Bob got up and, without a word to excuse himself, walked out of the room. The second meeting on July 18th was a repeat performance by Kennedy, except that this time, after again arriving late, he lashed into not only Taylor but also into Johnson's other man on the committee, NASA Director James Webb, firing a barrage of questions at him, as Webb, not knowing the answers, kept turning to an aide named Hartson behind him, who, it became clear, didn't know them either. When Webb tried to defend Hartson, Kennedy interrupted. "Excuse me, this committee and the President of the United States are interested in this program. I don't see that the job will be done. This gentleman over here, Hartson, that spent a year and a half on this program, I don't think he is going to get the job done. I am trying to ask some questions. I don't think I am able to get the answers, to tell you the truth." It was, Conway says, a pretty brutal business, very sharp. It brought tensions between Johnson and Kennedy right out on the table and very hard. Everybody was sweating under the armpits. And then, finally, after completely humiliating Webb and making the vice president look like a fraud and shutting up Hobart Taylor completely, Kennedy abruptly stood up. Johnson had started trying to explain the situation to him. "For your information, Mr. Attorney General, we of the committee have met with the leading agencies who have the most contracts, namely the Department of Defense. The Defense Department told us they had some 30 or 40 people working on this. Mr. Webb doesn't do that. This man here, Hartson, doesn't do it any more than you try to call a case in the Department of Justice. You've got a district attorney down there that does that." To Judge Lawson, it was very obvious that he was angry, but he was clearly more in control, or more dignified in the encounter, than Bob was. But as he was speaking, Kennedy started walking out of the room. Then, changing his mind, he walked around the table to where Conway was sitting, shook his hand, and stood there chatting with him, in Conway's words, about how things were going here, there, and every place, as casual and relaxed as if nothing else was going on, and then, while Johnson was still talking to him, walked out the door. As the door closed behind him, there was a great silence for a while before the meeting resumed, Judge Lawson says. If Bobby Kennedy was still trying to get revenge for Los Angeles, he got a full measure of it that day. After that meeting, Lyndon Johnson wasn't wound up anymore. In the late summer of 1963, Harry McPherson says, Johnson looked miserable. "More depressed," Horace Busby says, "than I had ever seen him. Nothing to do. Frustrated." Friends invited to swim and have dinner at the Elms were shocked when they saw him in a bathing suit. His weight had always fluctuated wildly. Now he had gone from thin to fat. Very fat. His belly, enormous, McPherson says. He looked absolutely gross. His face was flushed and mottled. Maybe he had been drinking a good deal. Sitting by the pool, he seemed unable to relax for a moment. Grabbing the phone impatiently, he would make a call, his conversation jerking without transition from one topic to another. Then, hanging up abruptly, he would make another call, and another. The fact that Robert Kennedy had not only harassed him, humiliated was the word he used, "he humiliated me," but had done so in public, and in fact in a setting, a meeting packed with government officials that ensured that the scene would become known throughout the Capitol, had in Johnson's mind the most ominous implications. That it was no longer just 1968 that the Kennedys were thinking about, but 1964, that they were planning to drop him from the ticket in the next election. Bobby would never have made him look ineffectual and incompetent if he was still going to be his brother's running mate. He felt his suspicions were confirmed when Kennedy loyalists began spreading the story of the meeting around Washington. Washington had had its suspicions even before the confrontation. By the summer of 1963, speculation was rife that he was going to be dumped from the ticket. Dampening the speculation was the fact that every time the president was asked about the rumors, he denied them. "There have been rumors in print and out that Vice President Johnson might be dropped," a reporter asked him on one occasion. "I am sure that the vice president will be on the ticket if he chooses to run," Kennedy replied. "We were fortunate to have him before, and would again. I don't know where such a rumor would start." "Assuming that you run next year, would you want Lyndon Johnson on the ticket, and do you expect he'll be on the ticket?" he was asked at another press conference. "Yes to both of these questions," Kennedy replied. "That is correct." Denying the rumors in private, he was equally emphatic. When Ben Bradley asked him after a quiet dinner for the two men and their wives upstairs in the White House in October, if he was considering dumping Johnson, he said, "That's preposterous on the face of it. We've got to carry Texas in 64 and maybe Georgia." When George Smathers, riding with him on Air Force One in November, said, "Everybody on the Hill says Bobby is trying to knock Johnson off the ticket," he said, "George, you have some intelligence, I presume. Why would we want to knock Lyndon Johnson off the ticket? Can you see me now in a terrible fight with Lyndon Johnson, which means I'll blow the South? I don't want to be elected, do you mean? You know, I love this job. I love every second of it. I don't want to get licked, and he's going to be my vice president because he helps me." "What do you mean, am I going to dump Johnson?" he had demanded when his friend Paul B. Red Fay visited him in the Oval Office in the spring. "What do you ask a question like that for? Of course I'm not. He's doing an excellent job in the most thankless position in Washington. He's my man for the job. He's going to be my man in 64, and I don't know why you're asking." No denials could have been more unequivocal. John Kennedy's assurances, in public and private, that Johnson would be on the ticket were, in fact, as unequivocal as his assurances in 1960 that Johnson would not be on the ticket. No one could have echoed the denials more firmly than Robert Kennedy. "There was no plan to dump Lyndon Johnson," he would say in his oral histories. "There was never any discussion about dropping him." Unless it was Lyndon Johnson in his later years. "Reports that I was going to be dumped from the ticket were rumors and nothing more," he wrote in his autobiography. "I had every reason to believe that he intended for us to go forward together." What some people did not understand was that our relationship had always been one of mutual respect, admiration, and cooperation. The denials made their way into the historical record. "The ticket was definitely to be the same," Arthur Schlesinger would write in 1978. He knew because Kennedy's brother-in-law and campaign strategist Stephen Smith had told him so. Emphatically. Indeed, it has become an historical axiom, totally accepted, that there was never any serious discussion of dropping Johnson from the ticket. That, as Schlesinger put it in 1980, "there was no discussion. This idea is total fantasy." "I have never encountered anything that corroborates the story that he would be dropped," Max Frankel says, adding that in addition to the political considerations, there was John Kennedy's personality. Whether he would have been capable of the ultimate, really, destruction of Lyndon Johnson, I would doubt it. Johnson's conviction at the time that he would be dumped, and in complete contrast to later statements, his conviction at the time was firm. "In the back room they were quoting Bobby saying I was going to be taken off the ticket," is explained away by amateur psychoanalysis. Obsessed is the word Reedy used to describe this conviction. His complaints against Bobby Kennedy may have bordered on the paranoiac, is Bobby Baker's analysis. Among the other things Bobby was doing to him was to drive him from the national ticket. The axiom has endured to this day, accepted without question in the most recent biographies of Lyndon Johnson. Yet in fact, as summer turned to fall in 1963, the question of whether Lyndon Johnson would be on John Kennedy's ticket again was beginning to be shrouded in ambiguities. His value to a Kennedy ticket had rested on very solid ground in 1960. Kennedy had needed at least a few southern states, and in particular Texas, to win the presidency, and the best way to win these states was to have Lyndon Johnson as his running mate. By 1963, however, that ground was shifting beneath Kennedy's feet, and it was shifting fast. In 1960, Kennedy's civil rights record had been inoffensive enough to minimize the antagonism of Southern white voters, and therefore it was possible for him to win some Southern states, and Texas if he had a Southern running mate. But in 1963, there had been his outmaneuvering of Governor Wallace, and on June 13th, he had delivered an inspiring televised address in which he said that civil rights was a moral issue, as old as the scriptures and as clear as the American Constitution. And not paranoia, but only polls were required to explain Lyndon Johnson's fears. One, taken in September 1963 by the Democratic National Committee, showed that if the election were held then, Kennedy would lose not only Texas, but Georgia, Louisiana, Arkansas, and both Carolinas, the states whose electoral votes were largely responsible for his victory in 60. Another, by the Gallup organization, showed that winning the South would not only be much more difficult for him in 1964, but that it might in fact be all but impossible if the Republican candidate was one whose stance on civil rights was attractive to that region. And by the fall of 1963, it was becoming increasingly likely that the Republican candidate would be one with a very attractive stance. Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona. Gallup pitted Kennedy against Goldwater head-to-head in a 13-state block, the 11 of the old Confederacy, and Kentucky and Oklahoma on its borders, and the result was Kennedy 41%, Goldwater 59%. And Johnson's own stance on civil rights had changed, of course, and while it had given him a new popularity in liberal precincts of the North, it hadn't had the same effect in the cotton mills of the South, as conversations in the Senate cloakroom showed. "I don't know what's got into Lyndon, but he's out talking Bobby Kennedy and civil rights," one Southern senator said. "Lyndon never had a more devoted admirer than myself," said another. "Now I wouldn't give 2 cents for his winning an election in my state." And those mills were significant to Kennedy's re-election plans. Johnson had held the South for Kennedy in 1960. He might not be able to hold it in 1964. Democratic political strategists, interviewed by the Philadelphia Inquirer in the summer of 1963, said they doubted whether Johnson would be able to overcome anti-Kennedy sentiment in the Deep South stirred by civil rights unrest. The president and his political advisers probably have written off the South for 1964 on the civil rights issue, the Cleveland Plain Dealer said. If they haven't, they should. Polls were showing as well that holding the South might no longer be imperative for Kennedy's re-election, so long as he did better in the North than he had in 1960. And they were showing also that his popularity was holding fairly steady there, at about 60%. Strength in the North, holding the big northern states he had won in 1960, and picking up states such as Ohio that he had lost, and picking up also some electoral votes in the West, most importantly California's 32 that he had lost in 60, might be the key to victory in 64. It might be more important he have a running mate who added strength to the ticket in those areas rather than in the South. Which led, of course, to the subject of Lyndon Johnson. If the solid South is to be written off in 1964, the question is whether Mr. Johnson will be retained on the ticket, and if so, what his function will be, the New York Times asked. The question was being asked more and more by Democratic strategists, however much the Kennedys denied it. Asked so frequently that in October the syndicated columnists Robert S. Allen and Paul Scott could write that a new political strategy is being hammered out at the party's secret deliberations, a strategy which calls for major Democratic efforts to increase the party's vote in all the northern industrial areas to offset expected Republican gains in the South. Specific names were starting to be mentioned, Pat Brown of California, for example. If the Democrats have written off the South for 1964, the question becomes whether they should recognize this fact publicly and go west for a vice presidential candidate. Kennedy strategists are saying that they may have to carry California to win next year, but California is where Barry seems to be running best. Will the president decide that his best chance lies with a Californian or some other Westerner as his running mate? And then there was the situation in Lyndon Johnson's own state. Carrying Texas against the conservative tide rising there had, of course, been hard even in 60, even with those votes from the Rio Grande Valley. And since 60, that tide, strengthened by a backlash against civil rights, had been rising even faster. In 1961, John Tower became the first Republican United States Senator elected from Texas since Reconstruction. And as the United Press reported on October 2nd, the mere mention of Goldwater as the GOP presidential nominee in 1964 has caused thousands of conservatives to change party affiliation, sending them into a booming Republican Party in Texas. Were the Arizona conservative to be the nominee, state GOP leaders were predicting, he would carry the state by even more than the 200,000 vote margin Eisenhower had rolled up. Kennedy's approval ratings in Texas, which had been slipping steadily, falling to 59% in May, had been plummeting since then, and in September, according to the state's definitive Belden poll, were down to 50%. Johnson's popularity, tied to his, had dropped to the same level. His identification with Jack Kennedy was only one of his problems in Texas. What George Reedy had warned against 2 years before, that he would be forgotten in his home state, had in fact occurred. After 3 years of trying to stay out of the news, to the mass of the state's voters, he was no longer nearly as towering a figure as he had been. And with the Texans who mattered most in the state's politics, the reactionary, in fact, ultra-reactionary business establishment, the oil men and big government contractors who had always been the source of his most important support, financial and otherwise, with these men his position was even more precarious. Haters of Roosevelt, of the New Deal, of liberals in general, they had never really forgiven him for going on Kennedy's ticket. They had taken his decision to do so, after they had contributed so generously to his campaign against Kennedy, as an act of betrayal, and that decision had, in their eyes, been only the beginning of his apostasy. They had believed all those years, because he had made them believe, that he felt the same way as they did about people of color. Basically, Lyndon was more conservative, more practical than people understand, George Brown says. You get right down to the nut-cutting, he was practical. He was for the niggers, he was for labor, he was for the little boys, but by God, he was as practical as anyone. Reading what Lyndon was saying about civil rights now, they wondered if he had been deceiving them all along. During the 3 years since 1960, moreover, there had been what was, in their minds, a more mortal sin, one that involved not philosophy, but money. To cool their rage over his acceptance of the vice presidential nomination, he had told them that by becoming a part, an important part, the number two man of the Kennedy administration, he would be in a position to moderate its policies from the inside, to act as a rein on liberal tendencies, and in particular, he had let them understand that he would be able to be a force within the administration against the tendencies that mattered most to them. Tendencies to regulate and reduce their wealth. Business regulation, tax reform, all forms of government intervention in their enterprises, these matters, as Brown and Root lobbyist Frank C. Posh Oltorf was to put it, transcended ideology. That's how they viewed politics. Any son of a bitch who makes me $1 million can't be all bad. As long as you put dollars in their pockets, they'd forgive your ideology. When it became apparent to them that Johnson did not, in fact, have the power to protect them from the liberal impulse, that, to them, was the unforgivable sin. Early in 1963, a quote from a Texas businessman appeared in the Washington Whispers column of U.S. News & World Report. Lyndon as vice president just can't do as much for Texas anymore as he could as Senate leader. That quote was mild. What was being said about Lyndon Johnson in the Petroleum Club of Houston and the Riata Club of Dallas and the other big business watering holes of Texas wasn't. He had promised to protect them, says Ed Clark, attorney for some of the biggest of them, and he couldn't deliver. He couldn't deliver. Kennedy was still proposing tax reform legislation, bills to close tax loopholes. Loopholes? Those were their loopholes he, Kennedy, was talking about, Posh Altorf says. In particular, there was the oil depletion allowance. Although the Kennedy plan ostensibly kept the rate of the allowance at 27.5%, the oilman's attorneys, analyzing the measure, had concluded that changes proposed by the administration in the tax code would cut the effective rate to just 17.5%. To the rest of the world, such a reduction would be only justice, or at least the beginning of justice. To the oilmen, it was robbery. The change, together with the elimination of some of the 100 hidden tax breaks for oil in the Internal Revenue Code, would cost them millions, perhaps billions of dollars a year. These big businessmen who controlled so much of the state's political machinery were no longer enthusiastic about controlling it on behalf of Lyndon Johnson. Not at all. He was losing some of his grip on the party machinery of that state, U.S. News reported. As Johnson's star had been waning in Texas, furthermore, another star, that of John Connally, elected governor in 1962, had been rising. The same Belden poll that showed Kennedy Johnson's approval at 50% put Connally's at 61%, and likely to go higher. Formerly undecided voters had begun swinging over to him. Lyndon Johnson's one-time assistant was heading rapidly toward the pinnacle he would one day occupy as a three-term governor, one of the most popular and powerful in the history of the state. No sooner had Connally moved into the governor's mansion in Austin, moreover, than he began to demonstrate that the organizational and political skills he had deployed for Lyndon Johnson were just as effective on his own behalf. Sitting on the fence of his ranch in Floresville just after sunrise one morning decades later, watching Mexican vaqueros exercising his stable of quarter horses, he would say, "One thing I'm proudest of. We built the strongest organization in the history of the state while I was governor." His pride was justified, and the base of his power was the people who controlled Texas, the powerful conservative establishment. Lyndon might have turned liberal. They didn't have to worry about John. He was already, in the first year of his governorship, showing that he was willing to lower taxes on banks and business, and to fight proposals by liberals in the legislature for increases in the minimum wage. They saw also that he was, as governor, talking the same way he had talked as Lyndon Johnson's aide and Sid Richardson's lawyer, as he had been talking all his life. He shared their views with the fervency of the true believer. Johnson and Connally still had the same political base, Joe Kilgore says, but as the congressman adds, it had become just a little bit more John's political base than Lyndon's. Adding to the significance for the Kennedys of the Texas businessmen's affection for the governor they were starting to call Big John was the pivotal role that Texas traditionally played in the financing of Democratic presidential campaigns. The Kennedys were counting on major help from Texas now, and the businessmen would contribute at Connally's direction. John controlled the money in the state now, Kilgore says. All through 1962, the president had been asking Johnson to arrange a fundraising trip to Texas, and there had been no result. The president may once have thought that Johnson could again deliver the Texas money, but by 1963, the White House had begun to recognize that that was no longer the case. For two decades, Lyndon Johnson had been the key to the electoral votes and the money of the great province in the Southwest. He wasn't anymore, and he knew it. He was telephoning Kilgore almost every night now, and the congressman felt he knew why. "Because I was close to John, he was scared to death that John would control the state in 1964 and might not be controlling it entirely for him." Kilgore, who had traveled the valley with Johnson and Connally during two long election campaigns, knew Johnson's worries were baseless. That however much the quarter-century-long ties between the two men, the loyalty, the psychological ties that bound Connally to Johnson might fray, in the end they would hold. "Of course John would have been for him when the chips were down," he says. But Lyndon wasn't confident of that. The falling out had to come to an end. After the talk started of Kennedy replacing him in 1964, We were in constant contact, Connolly says dryly. He and I talked about the possibility that he would be dropped from the ticket. He told me, Bobby's around talking about dumping me. We've got to show him that we've got the power down here. Connolly knew that Johnson was calling him now because he needed him. He knew I controlled the Texas delegation. And Texas, he was to tell the author. And he knew why Johnson and Kennedy needed him. I had frankly been elected by the people that President Kennedy needed most, by the moderates and conservatives of the state. They were not supporting him, and he was looking at a tough election, at least in our part of the country, in 1964. He understood that when Johnson talked about the necessity of showing the Kennedys that we've got the power down here, he really meant showing the president that he, Lyndon Johnson, had power, that he still had power. Connolly was very careful to try to leave that impression in the White House and to make it clear that Johnson would be the same asset to the ticket in Texas that he had always been, and that he, the governor of Texas, considered it imperative that Johnson be Kennedy's running mate. After one conversation with Connolly, Jack Kennedy told Evelyn Lincoln, "The one thing I noticed above everything else was his concern about Lyndon being on the ticket." Jack Kennedy was not an easy man to fool, however. Johnson did not want the president to see for himself how little prestige and influence the vice president then had in his own home state, Ken O'Donnell was to write, in a comment that shows that the president had seen. The more liberal Texas Democrats had always been against him, O'Donnell wrote, and since he had joined the New Frontier, his fellow conservatives had turned against him. By early 1963, the president was becoming quite insistent on arranging that fundraising trip to Texas, but Johnson, aware that funds would be raised only on Connolly's say-so, had had to admit that the matter should be arranged through the governor. And Connolly, who had, as O'Donnell understood, no desire to be marked as a Kennedy supporter in Texas, had been stalling off the president, using as an excuse the fact that he was in the midst of his first legislative session as governor. Finally, during a presidential swing through the West in June, Kennedy, Connolly, and Johnson were alone in a hotel room in El Paso. "Well, Lyndon, are we ever going to get this trip to Texas worked out?" Kennedy asked. But as Connolly knew, while he was addressing Vice President Johnson, he was speaking to me. And Johnson's reply, "Well, the governor is here, Mr. President, let's find out," was a tacit admission that decisions about the trip were Connolly's to make. "I knew at that point my string had run out," Connolly was to recall, but he asked Kennedy what kind of a trip he had in mind, and Kennedy proposed that the trip revolve around Johnson's birthday, August 27th, and that there be five separate fundraising dinners in the state's five principal cities, Dallas, Houston, Fort Worth, San Antonio, and Austin. Connolly, shocked at the scope of the proposal, said he would like to think about that. Holding the dinners on Johnson's birthday would be a serious mistake, because it was too hot in Texas in August. People weren't interested in politics in August. It was, he told Kennedy, the worst month of the year to have a fundraising affair in Texas. During the summer, Johnson kept trying to persuade Connolly to accept the multi-dinner proposal, and Connolly kept replying, "Well, that is a mistake." Kennedy was later to tell his wife that John Connolly wanted to show that he was independent and could run on his own, and he wanted to show that he didn't need Lyndon Johnson. Indeed, he didn't, and the polls that summer were proving that, and the Kennedys read polls. And if Connolly didn't need Lyndon Johnson, was Johnson really what Jack Kennedy needed in Texas? If Connolly was more popular and also controlled the money he needed, perhaps it was Connolly he should be working through instead. Furthermore, Connolly would be running for re-election in November 1964. Whether or not Lyndon Johnson was Jack Kennedy's running mate, the name of a powerful, popular Texan would be on the ballot with him. The whole situation in Texas was an irritant to Kennedy. His vice president was from Texas, yet he was being told it would be difficult to carry the state. "That thought irked him," Connolly was to say. "We shouldn't have a hard race in Texas," the president told the governor. A feud, personal as well as political, between Connolly and United States Senator Ralph W. Yarborough had split the state's Democrats into two bitterly hostile factions. A presidential candidate wants a united party behind him in key states when he is running. The last thing we want is a big political fight in Texas in 1964, O'Donnell had told Yarborough back in January. But since then, the feud had grown only more bitter, and the vice president wasn't helping to mend it, and Kennedy had become aware that he couldn't help much, that, as the president was to tell Ben Bradley that fall, Johnson had become a less viable mediator than he had been. If Johnson wasn't the best person to raise money for him in Texas, if he wasn't particularly popular in Texas, if he wasn't a particularly viable mediator in Texas, what was the reason to keep him on the ticket? On September 2, 1963, Johnson was to leave for Stockholm and a 15-day tour of five Scandinavian nations. And about a week before the trip, he told Ken O'Donnell that, as Charles Bartlett relates, he'd like to see the president before he went and have a little bit of a send-off from the president to boost his own role. One of the weaknesses of the Kennedy White House staff was that individuals became rather arrogant, Bartlett was to recall. O'Donnell said it was impossible. Reedy went hat in hand to Kennedy's military aide, Major General Ted Clifton, who went directly to the president, and Kennedy said that Johnson's plane could touch down at Hyannisport on its way to Stockholm, and the vice president could have a brief talk. Kennedy had asked a house guest, his old friend Red Fay, if he'd like to sit in on the talk, and Fay was strongly conscious, as he was to write, of the contrasts in the room. The president in a sport shirt and blazer, the vice president too formal in both appearance, overdressed as someone overdresses out of insecurity, in a double-breasted blue suit that seemed unusually somber in contrast to Kennedy's casual attire, and manner. Sitting forward uncomfortably on the edge of his chair, very deferential, very grateful to have been granted the audience. The apparent uneasiness and unsureness of the vice president surprised me, Fay was to write. The conversation couldn't have done much to boost his confidence. After discussing his Scandinavian itinerary, he said he would like permission to add a visit to Poland, saying, as Fay recalls, that it would be a dramatic sign of our desire to be friendly with the countries behind the Iron Curtain that have shown a desire for freedom. Permission was refused. Has this been cleared by the State Department? Kennedy asked, and when Johnson said it hadn't because he wanted to get Kennedy's reaction first, Kennedy said he didn't think it was a good idea at this time. Maybe sometime later, he said. Then Kennedy asked to see the prepared speeches for the trip, and when Reedy provided him copies, not only read them, but edited them, turning the pages rapidly, crossing out paragraphs and lines. When he finished, he simply handed Johnson the pages. "They were very good," he said. "I have crossed out a few short sections which won't hurt the speeches, but which are better left unsaid." A few minutes later, the visit was over. Johnson and Reedy were out the door. Johnson hadn't been asked for comment on Kennedy's changes. He had been treated like a speechwriter, and not a particularly respected one at that. On October 4th, John Connolly flew up to Washington to participate in a number of meetings on Texas problems, including one with President Kennedy to make definite plans for the president's trip to the state. He had told Johnson he was coming to Washington, and Johnson had invited him for dinner that evening at the Elms. But he hadn't told Johnson he was meeting with the president, and neither had the president. Connolly was to say that when he entered the Oval Office, he, frankly, was a bit surprised that the vice president wasn't there, but he wasn't. The meeting was very cordial. Connolly proposed that Kennedy's visit, for which the dates of November 21st and November 22nd had been tentatively set, include visits to five cities, as Kennedy wanted, but only one fundraising affair, $100 per plate dinner in Austin on the 22nd. Otherwise, Connolly said, people down there are going to think that all you are interested in is the financial rape of the state. And I used those words, and Kennedy said he would accept Connolly's judgment. When Connolly arrived at the Elms that evening, Johnson already knew that I'd been with the president. His first words were, "Well, did you all get the trip worked out?" The vice president, he was to say, was considerably irritated with me. Irritated, Connolly said, wasn't quite the right word. Hurt was the right word. But what could Connolly say? "I suppose you think I don't have any interest in what is happening in Texas," Johnson said. "No," Connolly said, "I know you are extremely interested in what is happening in Texas." "Why didn't you tell me?" Johnson asked. Connolly said he had assumed he knew about the appointment, trying to alibi any way I could because I recognized that he was really irritated about it. But Johnson kept pressing him. Connolly didn't want to hurt him any more than he had already been hurt, but he finally